Today on Against the Grain, the failed German Revolution, in which he was a participant, marked the Marxist philosopher Herbert Marcuse for life. But unlike some of his more pessimistic colleagues in the Frankfurt School, particularly after the rise of fascism, Marcuse did not give up on liberatory possibilities. In the 1960s, Marcuse became one of the key philosophers of the New Left, in which he found a mass audience. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Nick Torkelson about Marcuse's life, ideas, and continuing relevance. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Arguably, some of the central issues of our time involve authoritarianism versus liberation, especially with the rise of the populist right around the world. These were themes that animated the life of philosopher Herbert Marcuse. Born in Germany in 1898, he participated in the failed revolution that followed World War I and then observed the rise of the Nazis in the 1920s and 30s as a member of the influential Institute for Social Research, otherwise known as the Frankfurt School. When the Nazi threat led to the relocation en masse of the Frankfurt School to the United States, Marcuse examined not only the forces of repression, but the liberatory impulses in society toward utopian change. Reviled by the likes of then-California Governor Ronald Reagan and John Wayne, he found himself threatened and out of a job on more than one occasion. But he also found a mass audience in second-wave feminism and the New Left. Author and illustrator Nick Torkelson has written a graphic biography of Marcuse, in effect a comic book of weighty ideas, called Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia. It's published by City Lights Books. Nick, what were Marcuse's origins, and into what world was he born?
He was born into the assimilated German Jewish bourgeoisie. His father owned a factory at the time he was born, and so did his grandfather, his mother's father. And the story that is always told, which I use in the book to express what that culture was like, is that Marcuse used to say that in his neighborhood as a child, you would hear somebody leaning out the window and saying, "Siegfried, Brunhilde, it's time for Shabbos." So this was that. And like a lot of his colleagues later in the Frankfurt School, he was encouraged to be to have the kind of culture that would signify the arrival of into the comfortable classes, and that was part of the impetus. And there's no saying what else went into his tremendous intellectual curiosity, except that then he was a soldier and had the experiences that set the course for him.
World War I was a horrible slaughter, and Germany was, of course, one of the losing powers. What were the circumstances of that moment in Marcuse's young adulthood and his participation in the revolutionary politics in Germany at the time?
Yes, he became interested in socialism as a soldier. He had poor eyesight, so he didn't see any action. He was in the rear echelon taking care of the horses. And he was appalled by the corruption of the war and the slaughter and the arrogance of the officer classes, which was extreme and probably much in a very different and very vexing way in the rear echelon compared to where the fighting was going on. And in the comic, this is, you know, a lot of, in a graphic biography, you have to make some stuff up because you're not there, so you supply some words for the people. And for me, I imagined, without knowing that this ever happened, that he overheard two plutocrats at their private club saying, "Isn't this war wonderful? This is how the money rolls in." We know that from his recollections that profiteering and the great fortunes that were created by the war for for certain people was part of what made him want to look for a different way. And so he was recruited into the Social Democratic Party, and he came out of and at the end of the war, after the Social Democratic Party had the advantage of an uprising to replace the monarchy with a republic, and then turned against the working class people who were their base, he joined the rebellion against the Social Democratic Party, which he had belonged to, and he joined. He was a soldier's delegate, and he took up arms against the regime. That was the Spartacist uprising that led to the martyrdom of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and others, and it was the first of a number of traumas that informed his thinking, and made him a revolutionary, and made him, and unlike many people in the Spartacist rebellion who then went on to form the German branch of the communist movement, he did not go for that. He thought that they were too attached to the Soviet Union as opposed to the socialist cause, and so he kept himself independent, but he was very much of the left, and while not an active revolutionary distributing rifles to anybody, he was looking in his intellectual work for ways of thinking about radical change and revolutionary change.
So you were just describing how the 1919 uprising gave Marcuse a taste of revolution, and that was to become an abiding theme throughout his life, revolution and the possibility of utopian transformation of society. And yet, of course, the period that followed that, the Weimar years, were times of enormous tumult, certainly of militancy on the far left, but also the far right. Tell us about that period, what was going on in terms of the world of ideas and culture, and then also on the street.
Well, in my book, there are a couple of pages or so devoted to the culture of that time, and it allowed me to talk about some of the stuff that has interested me for a long time, the theater of Brecht and Weill and Eisner, and that bohemian segueing into left-wing culture that we associate with Weimar, and also the new objectivity movement, which produced George Grosz's extremely powerful and upsetting images of what he saw around him, of the corruption and the brutality of that society. And politically, it was a time that reminds me of the aftermath of the Vietnam War, where you had in this country you had Vietnam veterans against the war who were extreme rebels. I don't like that word extreme for them. I thought they were reasonable rebels who learned on account of their experiences in the war what a corrupt system had created that war and made people want to think about ways of struggling against that. And at the same time, it created the backlash, super patriotic POW MIA kind of veteran consciousness that was pushing in the opposite direction. So in Germany, chiefly with the communists on one side and the Nazis on the other, you had tremendous participation by war veterans, and some of them looked at the war. They were both talking about war as trauma, but for one group, the trauma was that capitalism had created an impossible situation and a lethal situation, and for the other group, the trauma of war signified that they had been betrayed and that they did not get the glory that they deserved because they were stabbed in the back by the civilian and Jewish traitors back at home. So that is something that I think carries through both of Marcuse's important periods, the times that formed him and the times when he was famous and had a great influence.
Marcuse became interested in the philosophy of Martin Heidegger, who attracted a following in these years and had a very complicated political future. But at that moment, people like Hannah Arendt and others flocked to his lectures. Now, Marcuse is someone coming out of the left, out of a left-wing political world. What attracts him about Heidegger, and what did Heidegger offer that was not offered by the reigning ideas of the time, including Orthodox Marxism?
Well, the way I look at it, and these are very dense and difficult ideas, and I did my best. I have no philosophical training, so I was very helpful to read the writings of Andy Feinberg, who was a graduate student of Marcuse's and wrote a lot about the Heidegger-Marcuse relationship. The way I understand it is that having decided to go into academia because he did not see any place for him in the politics of that time, he started to study philosophy, and the reigning orthodoxy of the time was the neo-positivists of the so-called Vienna School, who, to his mind, in their sense of how do we know, how do we perceive, and all these philosophical questions, were basically leaving you with the impression that reality is immutable and what you see is what you get, and don't make waves because that's out there and that's real, and your subjectivity is merely subjectivity. So what I think happened when he read Being and Time, the magnum opus of Martin Heidegger, was that he was thrilled by Heidegger's idea that you know something by doing it, you know something by acting upon it, and that this heroizing and philosophizing of action and taking responsibility for the world and not assuming that it is immutable and that it's going to control you was how his philosophical pursuits meshed with his political history at that point. And so he speaks of having a friend and reading Being in Time word for word for days on end, and then spending hours talking about it. And there was nothing he could do besides go to Freiburg, where Heidegger was teaching by then, and be his graduate student and his assistant. And he also worked with Heidegger's mentor, Edmund Husserl, who was at Freiburg also. So that was the connection as I make it out. And as the book lays out, he began to try and write about his thoughts in connection to phenomenology and Heidegger, he began to see that there was not that the content of the action of the taking responsibility that Heidegger was talking about was not necessarily part of the philosophy, and that was something that was lacking. That the world that you're trying to create has a shape and a form and certain qualities, and that was missing. That was the beginning of his differentiating himself from Heidegger.
What ideas was he grappling with at that time? You know, much philosophy was focusing on the role of the artist. How did he see the role of the artist and the relevance of that to the larger society?
Marcuse had written, I think in the German system, I'm not sure if this is still true, but you did two dissertations, one to get the degree and one to get a job. So he had done his first dissertation on the subject of the artist novel. This is before he had his Saul of Tarsus moment and decided to work with Heidegger. He was, I'm not even certain that he had a strict philosophy discipline. I think he wanted to combine cultural studies with philosophy, and he was interested in his mentor at that point was not, I think maybe just a little older than him, George Lukács, who had written some really interesting stuff about how the artist in bourgeois society proceeds from a place of alienation, and that this was not always true and it need not be true. And so Marcuse wrote this very interesting dissertation called the German Artist Novel, tracing from medieval times from the Icelandic epics up through 20th century literature, and one of his favorite authors, Thomas Mann, with a special emphasis on Goethe in between, about how the artist came to this, how the artist came to seeing the world as something separate from their subjectivity. And so you can see how this meshes with the idea of the subjective soul and society, and the longing to break down that separateness between the lonely philosopher, the lonely artist, and the society outside, and reunite what had been an organic whole.
Nick Torkelson is my guest. We're talking about his graphic biography, which he's the author and illustrator of, Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia, and that's published by City Lights Books. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So tell us about the formation of the Institute for Social Research, which usually is referred to as the Frankfurt School, the grouping of thinkers around that, and how Marcuse ended up being involved in it.
Yes, the Institute for Social Research was founded by Felix Weil. He was, like Marcuse, a veteran who had come to some revolutionary and some Marxist ideas as a result of the bitterness of his experience in the war and the struggles afterwards. And it was an attempt to bring some people together to think about social change and in relation to culture, in relation to politics. And it was, the original director was not Felix Weil, it was Karl Grunberg, who was very attached to the Soviet experiment and had set up a formal relationship between the Institute and the Marx-Lenin Institute in Moscow, and was also, according to some of the students at the Institute, a somewhat naive optimist who saw history marching inexorably towards a socialist and cooperative future, and spoke of and was very interested in doing empirical research. When he became too ill to lead it, then Max Horkheimer took over, and he is remembered as the leader of the Frankfurt School in its glory days. And Theodor Adorno came in, Leo Lowenthal, and later on Erich Fromm, and around that same time Marcuse, who joined at the beginning of the 30s when it was clear that that the Nazis were on the march and that he was not going to have an academic career in Germany. So that's the origin story, and it's worth mentioning that the Felix Weil, like Herbert Marcuse, came from a very comfortable background. His father was a grain merchant who lived a large part of his career and did his business in South America. So the resources that supported the research of the Institute came from the Third World, I think you could say.
What were the Frankfurt School's preoccupations? Obviously, different thinkers, but what were the main preoccupations in terms of the ideas they were wrestling? And what was the relationship of the Frankfurt School with Marxism broadly conceived?
The Frankfurt School, I would say, is remembered for its critique of consumerism and false consciousness. They began by wanting to know why the revolution of 1919 failed. I think that was probably a major preoccupation in the 20s. And they then wrote a lot about authoritarianism as they saw the collapse of the left in Germany as the Nazis came to power, and in their years of exile during the war. And the Dialectic of Enlightenment, the major work of Adorno and Horkheimer, is about how the ideas of that we associate with republicanism and small R republicanism and the French Revolution and classic liberalism and the late Renaissance that led to modernity, that the seeds of authoritarianism and the seeds of a thoroughly administered society, as Adorno called it, were planted by these ideas that seem so progressive and that we think of as so progressive. And so I think, in total, the preoccupation of the Frankfurt School was authoritarianism and submission to authoritarianism, and as ballast against the rebellions and the transformations that Marxism predicted and hoped for. And I should say that as the Frankfurt School was suppressed by the Nazis and they had to flee, they were in the midst of what was going to be a gigantic empirical study of workers' attitudes, and this was at the time of tremendous mass socialist parties in Germany and throughout Central Europe, and even before their defeat, Erich Fromm and Paul Lazarsfeld managed the study of workers' attitudes, and they came to the conclusion after getting a lot of questionnaires back that many workers who identified with the left were nevertheless longing for leadership and were not being guided in their politics towards autonomy and towards liberation, what we would think of as liberation. And so a certain kind of radical pessimism was kind of built into their politics from the start.
So how did then the rise of Nazism end up affecting Marcuse and the Frankfurt School?
Very differently, I would say. The Frankfurt School went from Frankfurt to Geneva as it was becoming, after Hitler was announced, appointed chancellor. And they didn't find Switzerland particularly welcoming. This was a surprise to me when I was doing the research that there was a lot of fascist feeling in Switzerland, and there was a lot of fascist feeling in the U.S. It had not done the worst of the damage it was going to do, and a lot of people were very, very charmed or excited by that Heideggerian thing, the heroism against what is. That was the appeal of fascism for a lot of people, and the militarism of it was went with that. So Marcuse and a lot of his colleagues, especially in the exile community, not feeling very good about Geneva, they moved to New York and they affiliated with Columbia University. So during the war, their headquarters were on 117th Street in Manhattan. And Marcuse wrote a lot of articles for their journal, the Zeitschrift, I think it was called. And it became clear that he hoped for a democratic transformation as it became clear that the fascists were going to lose the war, that there was of course an alliance between left and right in those years, and an alliance between the U.S. and the Soviets, and tremendous hopes that from the ashes of fascism, or as the communists used to say, after Hitler, us, that there would be the makings, the resources for a radical transformation of capitalism, if not the abolition of capitalism. And for Horkheimer, the leader of the Institute, and for Adorno, his closest ally in the Institute and his co-author on the Dialectic of Enlightenment, these hopes were not very compelling, and they were much more interested in how the whole arc of revolutionism and radicalism and liberalism had within it the seeds of an authoritarian culture, and they had very little hope that anything could be done about this, which informed their response to the New Left when that came along some years later.
And how did Marcuse see that? Obviously, he lived through both the dark years of fascism, but also of the Moscow trials and an awareness of the crimes that were being committed in the Soviet Union. And yet he also held on to hopes of revolution. How did he see this?
Well, he went to work for the government as it became clear that he was not so much in tune with the Institute, although in the book, I got this very much from Marcuse's son, Peter, who was very helpful to me in putting this together. The break with the Institute came when they briefly shuttled off to California, basically because Horkheimer needed to be out of the Northeast for his health. And Horkheimer and Pollack, who was the administrative head of the Institute, cut Marcuse's pay and did everything they could to get him to back off of what they were doing. And at the same time, a lot of the emigre intellectuals were being offered work in government, analyzing the politics and the culture of Central Europe and of Germany in particular. And so I think it was very important in Marcuse's thinking that he went from Santa Monica to Washington, D.C. and helped the anti-fascist material cause, that is, the Allied side on the war. That was the parting of the ways, and that was when he became interested in taking a very close look at the Soviet Union and at how fascism had transformed Germany.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking today with the author and illustrator of the graphic biography Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia. That's published by City Lights Books, and you can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. Nick Torkelson is a Boston-based cartoonist, and his other books include The Comic Strip of Neoliberalism. So after the Frankfurt School, in effect, relocates, as you mentioned, to the U.S. during the war, of course, people like Walter Benjamin do not make it across, but quite a few German immigrants do make it to the United States, including Bertolt Brecht and others. After the war, the Frankfurt School relocates itself back to Germany. And as you've mentioned, Marcuse is not part of that. And there's an inward turn that much of the intellectual left takes in the post-war years. Tell us about that turn and how Marcuse understood it.
The 50s, Marcuse wrote the first of his two masterpieces called Eros and Civilization. And I think the subtitle is something like A Philosophical Encounter with Freud. So the title, Eros and Civilization, is a takeoff on Freud's pessimistic book, Civilization and Its Discontents. And what Marcuse was very fascinated by Freud and spoke from then on in Freudian terms about aggression and instinct and eros and thanatos and these Freudian terms and concepts. And he wanted to do a friendly critique of Freud's thought on the grounds that he felt that Freud, like his former colleagues in the Institute, had a brilliant critique, but did not see a way out. And Marcuse felt that there had to be a way out, that it was unacceptable to despair of civilization being fundamentally repressive or nothing or not civilization at all. Marcuse could not accept that idea, and that was why he wrote this book, talking about Eros, which is simply Cupid, you know, the in Freudian terminology, the life instinct, the instinct to live. And talking about that in sexual terms and in social terms as a force to be reckoned with and a force to pay, to respect, to give it its entire due and not say that it must submit in order for us to get along with each other. So that's the germ of the idea of Eros and Civilization. It's it's a fascinating book. It's my favorite of his books to the extent that I understand them.
So in that work, he grapples with the idea and something that obviously Freud does not, about the working day, about leisure. How did he understand the need to reduce the working day as part of this liberatory opening that could happen under other circumstances?
Yes, I think it's in that book that he develops what became his major and his very most encouraging idea, which is that we have surplus repression in what we're now calling late capitalism. Somebody said it's never late enough, but that's what we call it. And that was very exciting to me as I grappled with that book to realize that he was talking about a very practical matter, that people, in spite of these astonishing productivity gains, are still working much too hard and working in ways that are life deadening and miserable, and that these productivity gains should go towards creating a better life for all of us instead of just creating more products for us to buy so that there will be more jobs for people that they hate. And he says in that book, the reduction of the working day is absolutely essential to any idea of freedom coming out of the Industrial Revolution, freedom coming out of the productivity gains of modern society. And God knows that we still need that idea, and we still need to do something about it, because it hasn't really gotten a whole lot better since he wrote those words.
When he wrote his book, and it was published, The One-Dimensional Man, he catapulted into a position of being one of the celebrity philosopher of the New Left. Tell us about the argument that he makes in The One-Dimensional Man, which builds on the arguments of Eros and Civilization, and how it ended up reaching this mass audience. Obviously, something was happening in the United States at the time.
I think it's safe to say that he had the attention of feminists before One Dimensional Man came out. But yes, One Dimensional Man made him a rock star of philosophy, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it's not an exaggeration. He was one of those intellectuals who could not get a ticket to one of his talks. They were so popular, and everybody was talking about him. And the critique of consumerism was a big part of that. What he tries to get at in One Dimensional Man is a combination of what the Frankfurt School was famous for, talking about how you blunt the rebel urge, how you get people to lose their instinct for happiness and their instinct for a good life, and sublimate it, into acquisition. And he coined the phrase, I don't think I use it in the book, but repressive desublimation. He also piles onto the idea of sublimating Eros and talks about how modern society, and this is in the era of Hugh Hefner and the Playboy clubs and the lifting of censorship of sexual material with Lady Chatterley's Lover and Henry Miller, repressive desublimation is how you make room for the erotic at the expense of Eros. And this also dovetails with the feminist critique, I think. And so for people who were getting woke, as we say, by the civil rights movement and by the women's movement later on, and particularly by the Vietnam War, this was a way of thinking about how could a society that was supposedly democratic and freedom-loving support these oppressions and these atrocities.
One thing I guess one could say about Marcuse is that his was a life not only of all these rich ideas, but obviously of also kind of academic precarity. And having been forced to emigrate, booted out of the Frankfurt School, And he found himself, I guess, at the time, maybe not surprisingly, as he drew all of this interest and all of the support from the emerging New Left and feminist movement, he also drew the ire of the right, notably John Wayne and the KKK, but also Ronald Reagan, who was the governor of California. What was the price that he ended up paying for that interest?
Well, he had two academic posts. He was in his 50s when he got the first one at Brandeis. Both colleges that he worked at were new. Brandeis was launched after World War II, and the University of California San Diego campus was brand new when he got there towards the end of the 60s. And in both places, his writings got him into trouble. He went up against the pioneering president of Brandeis, Abram Secker, who could not understand why the students were. He of course was happy that students were flocking to Brandeis in order to study with Marcuse, but he was not happy that the donors were looking at this guy who was anti-capitalist on the staff of the university. And you have to remember that in the early 60s was a continuation of the 50s. It was still a very conservative time, and Marxism was off the table, socialism was off the table. There was not much room for people who believed in that sort of thing. So Sekar was having some trouble with fundraising, although he was not having much trouble with recruiting students because of Marcuse, and turned against him and forced him out. And then, of course, in the years of his greatest fame, when he was at San Diego, as you mentioned, Ronald Reagan singled him out by name as an enemy of the people, as somebody who could not possibly be allowed to teach in a state university. And Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, also attacked him by name. And in the course of Agnew's attack on Marcuse, he said the Agnews and I think it's fair to say the right wing idea of higher education is that it's vocational education. It's wrong to ask people to look too deeply into things. Just teach them how to build an airplane or a wind tunnel, and goodbye and good luck was Agnew's idea of what colleges should be doing. So that would have all been one thing, but then the newspapers got a hold of it, and San Diego was a very conservative city, a militarized city. And when they heard that students in Europe were shouting MMM when Marcuse spoke, meaning Mao, Marx, Marcuse, they said, how can this be? How can this be that this new university in our midst has somebody whose name is associated with Karl Marx? And all of the extreme right, the Klan and the Minutemen, threatened him and attacked him. There was an armed attack on his home that caused him and his second wife Inga to go into hiding. So it was serious. It was very serious. And Lowell Bergman, who I knew as an undergraduate in Madison, who went on to study with Marcuse, told me about how the grad students would walk him from the campus to his home armed in case of an incident. That's how bad it was.
Well, one of the things that drew attention to Marcuse and fed into the media's fixation on his ideas was his support of the idea of revolution. And I wanted to ask you, what did revolution mean to him, and how did it relate to this thread of an impulse towards utopia?
Well, that's a tough question and a very good one. I think Marcuse was no more than Karl Marx willing to speculate about exactly what a revolution would mean, although he spoke very concretely, as I said, of shortening the workday and all sorts of concrete things that could be done that would lead in the direction of his idea of a good life. But he did not concern himself with strategy and tactics, as far as I know, beyond supporting certain concrete things like that. And for him, the closest he comes to laying out what he means by revolution and what he means by liberation, and liberation is in the title of one of his books, is in Eros and Civilization and An Essay on Liberation, that short book that he did after One Dimensional Man, to where he says that the idea of liberation and revolution is to allow the whole human being to be at play and to have power and to have consciousness and fellowship with others. But I think it's, if you wanted to look for a criticism of Marcuse, you could say that his description of that good life was not very detailed. He just believed, and this is his subjectivity, which is the origin of all of his thought, the importance of the subjective is that he needed more than this society was giving him, and he saw that others were in the same situation. And that's what he called oppression, and it included the oppression of the poor, and he constantly expressed his debt to Angela Davis for teaching him about what extreme oppression means in American society and in Western society. But I think it also meant for him that thwarting, that feeling that his whole being, or the whole being of people who long for a satisfactory life, was not paid attention to and did not have scope.
I'm speaking with Boston-based cartoonist Nick Torkelson about the book which he illustrated and wrote, which is a graphic biography of Herbert Marcuse, Philosopher of Utopia. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Marcuse found a massive audience with the New Left, and he was supportive of the movements of the New Left, including the events in Paris in May 1968. And yet his earlier collaborators, who he stayed in touch with in the Frankfurt School, Adorno, Theodor Adorno in particular, ended up as a critic of the New Left and also in some ways the recipient of the ire of the New Left. How would you contrast their differing perspectives on the New Left and the debate they had between each other about it?
Well, in the book, I try to tie that difference to water. I have the Frankfurt School arriving in California that first time and saying, there's the Pacific Ocean, why don't we send out a message in the bottle, which I can't remember the German version of that image, but it's a very strong image in German culture, I guess. And somebody says, yeah, we should put a message in the bottle. And somebody else says, yeah, I should say, I feel so lousy. And there was, and this is the beginning of the break between Marcuse and his colleagues in the Institute, that they found the popular culture that had its headquarters in Los Angeles and in Southern California perfectly hideous. And Marcuse was much more ambivalent. He liked the water. He liked, and his colleagues Adorno and Horkheimer had a much more totalizing critique of mass culture than Marcuse did, I would say. And they were revolted by the life in America, and they couldn't wait to get back to Germany after the war was over. And Marcuse stayed. He did not find it repulsive. It seems to me a much more easygoing and humorous and receptive soul than they were. And Joe Sacco, my hero in nonfiction cartooning, who I was in touch with about the book, said his only objection to the book was that I was too hard on Adorno, and I readily admit that I am not a big student of Adorno and a big reader of Adorno, and I'm don't want to take too much away from him since I am not an expert on that subject, but I think that's where the difference lies, that Marcuse was open, and he was open to the New Left, and Adorno was not. Adorno, when he saw posters making fun of him, he sued the people that were responsible for them. When he saw people occupying the offices of the Frankfurt School, he called the police, and that was the beginning of the final debate, the correspondence that I give a lot of quotes from in the comic, between Adorno and Marcuse right before Adorno died, where Adorno is saying, these are barbarians, these new leftists, and Marcuse is saying, but they are fighting the war in Vietnam, and Adorno is saying, well, if you're going to criticize the U.S. in Vietnam, you should criticize the National Liberation Front in Vietnam, because they're barbarians. And that was a pretty intense difference between these former fellow revolutionaries, that the ones in Germany were not receptive to the anti-war movement and to the anti-imperialist view of the world, and Marcuse was. And that was a big part of Marcuse's popularity. There were plenty of social critics in academia when I came of age in the 1960s, and some of them were sympathetic to the ideas of the New Left, and very few of them would support the militants and the actual actions of the New Left. But Marcuse was open to all of that.
And yet he was not without his criticisms of the New Left and the counterculture.
Yes.
And it's interesting to read at a time when certainly the more militants of the New Left were seeing revolution as around the corner, that Marcuse, who had kept the flame of revolution burning throughout his life, did not see that to be the case.
Yes, Marcuse said in an interview, which I reproduce almost entirely in the comic, was asked, do you see the New Left as revolutionary? He said, no. And he had a right to say that, because he had been in an authentic revolution. And he said, you can't have a revolution without the working class, and this is a student movement, so you should not be thinking of it as revolutionary. So he was alternately amused and critical of, or both at the same time, I guess, the what he, I believe, referred to as the megalomania of the New Left, that they saw themselves as being capable of more than they were capable of. And that word megalomaniac or megalomania I got from George Katsifikas, who was one of his students in San Diego, and who lived where I live in Boston for during his academic career. And he mentioned to me that he was working on an underground paper, and they talked about Nelson Rockefeller more or less quaking in his boots, because there was an anti-CIA coalition at the University of California, San Diego, and being Nelson Rockefeller being relieved that this group had disbanded. And Marcuse said, really? I don't think so. So there was that criticism of the megalomania. He was not crazy about rock and roll. He was his tastes were very highbrow, but he said some nice things about jazz, which Adorno famously couldn't bear jazz and was disgusted by the intelligentsia of embracing jazz as a legitimate art form. He could not see it at all. He said it's the music of slaves. It is not the music of people who can rise up, and that sort of thing. And Marcuse was more Catholic in his tastes, small c Catholic in his tastes.
Let me end by asking you about Marcuse's relevance in our times today. I'm presuming you think that he is relevant in that you went through the trouble of creating a graphic biography which makes the life and ideas and times, changing times, of Marcuse highly accessible. What's the relevance of Marcuse today? Why should we familiarize ourselves with his ideas?
Well, when I talk about that in my lengthy elevator speech, that is to say what I've been doing on this tour in bookstores, what I try to emphasize is that Marcuse always kept before him not simply the resistance to oppression, but the striving towards pleasure, towards a life where pleasure is possible, where real pleasure is possible. And I think the relevance of that is that even though the reappearance of semi-fascistic ideas in American politics and in American government has brought a lot of people to the left and to some comfortability with the idea of socialism and truly radical transformation, it also makes people a little afraid to think about what they really want, because what they want in first is to overcome this fascistic tendency in not just the United States, but now we see it in Hungary and Brazil and so on. And so I think when we started this project, it was pre-Trump, and I was looking at those ideas and that simultaneous critique and affirmation as totally consistent with the Occupy moment, which was clearly a utopian moment and a movement towards that was full of ideas about how life should be. And as the wheel turned and we had this extremely authoritarian and fascistic or neo-fascistic bent, that kind of dreaming, that kind of utopianism becomes dicey. And I think people are afraid to embrace it. And what I think Marcuse teaches us is you must never forget what you want, that you are, if you engage politically, you are not just resisting oppression, you're not just resisting authoritarianism, you're not just fighting to protect your friends and neighbors, which is absolutely crucial, but you are also trying to build a good life.
Nick Torkelson, thank you so much.
And I really want to thank you, Sasha. This was a great interview.
I've been speaking with the author and illustrator of the graphic biography, Herbert Marcuse, Philosophy of Utopia, published by City Lights Books and on againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to the book. He's a Boston-based cartoonist. His other books include The Comic Strip of Neoliberalism. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.